In chapter 5, we begin the second half of the two-part section of chapters 2 through 7 are written in the language of the Chaldeans. And I call it the second half because we have chapters 2, 3, and 4 that build up to the conversion climax of Nebuchadnezzar's experience with God finally getting him to the point where he would acknowledge that there's a God in heaven who rules over the kingdoms of men and sets over them whoever he chooses, and he's able to humble those that walk in pride. Now we're starting chapters 5, 6, and 7, which go in reverse order down the same themes, so that chapter 4 I call judgment with mercy, and chapter 5 is judgment without mercy. And then when we get to chapter 6, it'll be the parallel to chapter 4, and the issues of the persecution of the godly by the ungodly. Chapter 3 was the fiery furnace, and chapter 5 is the lion's den, and then chapter 2 was the great image, and chapter 7 is the four beasts. But we're still talking the same basic issues. So, this evening, we're going to be looking here at chapter 5 with Belshazzar. Now, a few things that we need to understand about the issue here. According to the end of the chapter, this is the last night of Belshazzar's life, which means it's the last day of the last year of his rule. So that when we read, for example, in chapter 8, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, we're going backwards in terms of chronology. This chapter 5 is deliberately chronologically out of order, and the reason is because Daniel's got a point to make. And chiasm always has as its point the top of the issue. When you build up to it and then you back away from it, that's the issue. And the real issue is, chapter 4, verse 37, he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And of course, that's the whole problem in chapter 5. So one of the things we need to be aware of is that we're going to start looking in chapter 5 at God's reaction to Belshazzar. Now, the thing that we need to understand about him is that his daddy was named Nabonidus, and he was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. So when it says in the queen's statement to him, it says, "There's a man in your kingdom," in verse 11, "King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king," he's actually his grandfather. But they use these terms to emphasize the relationship as it moves down. So Belshazzar's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel makes a very strong point of the fact that, hey, you were around when all this happened, Nebuchadnezzar, and you haven't been paying attention. So that's part of the issue. The other one is, according to verse 1, he held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. In the rest of the story, down through verse 4, is a story of a big drunken orgy, but it includes 1,000 of his top people, his nobles. And this makes most sense when you understand that this is the last night of his life. Because what's really going on historically is he's been surrounded. Babylon, the city, has been under siege by Darius the Mede and the Medo-Persian army. And they've been there for a long time. And the city has been closed up. Now, for Babylon, that's not a big issue because the walls of Babylon were over 300 feet high. And they were over 75 feet thick. And they had cedar gates that were encased in bronze. So they had metal gates. So you couldn't ram a burning wagon against the gate and burn it up because it wouldn't burn. And you couldn't throw up a ladder and climb over the top because it's 300 feet high. At 75 feet, you could ride four chariots side by side around the top of the wall if you really wanted to make a show. So this feast is basically an attempt to keep the morale up because they've been surrounded now for months, and you can get bored when there's no internet and no TV. And the walls that are 300 feet tall are keeping you in as well as keeping them out. So this is a morale builder. And he obviously feels like that the best way to build the morale is to have a big orgy party. And so that's what he's doing. It says in verse 1, he was drinking wine in the presence of the thousand, but he wasn't the only one drinking the wine. And then, when he tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, i.e. his grandfather, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. So here we have the fact that not only were the thousand there, but all his wives and his concubines, and no telling what else was going on there. And they were all just getting drunk. The king, though, felt like that the best thing to do was to exalt the gods of Babylon, because they still had this superstitious religion where you have to be on the right side of your gods if you want to be successful. And so he's drinking out of the gold vessels that have been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. But the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines are drinking the wine and praising the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So this is a deliberate religious issue stuck in here so that they're involved in their orgy in the tradition of Mardi Gras. You know, it has always puzzled me how in the world you can have the debauchery of Mardi Gras as a religious holiday. But this is exactly what's going on here. Their view of their gods was that their gods were not moral. And they didn't have to be moral either. They just had to be on the good side of them. And the good side of them didn't mean being righteous. It meant honoring them, praising them, bowing and scraping, at least outwardly, because that's what impressed them. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't bow before my gods, I'll burn you in a fiery furnace. And all he was really after was their obedience to him. The guy was brilliant, but he was an egomaniac, and he didn't have any understanding at all, that child thing, you know, I'm standing up on the inside even if I'm sitting down on the outside. That mindset is totally foreign to the pagans and their gods, because the gods were egomaniacs and they wanted the humans to bow down and bow and scrape and praise, and it didn't matter to them whether they were moral or not or righteous or any of that kind of thing. So that's what's going on here. The problem is, according to Daniel, this decision to bring the vessels of the house of God in Jerusalem out and use those vessels was a direct slap in the face to the God of Israel, the God of the Jews. He was praising the gods of gold, silver, and bronze, iron, wood, and stone, and using the vessels of the house of the God of the Jews. So this was not some minor problem. It was a direct rejection of the God of heaven, who is able to humble the proud, according to the last verse of the previous chapter. So, when they were doing this, it says, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Just a word of explanation there. According to the excavations of the palace, there was a kind of an inset in the wall where the big room, feasting area was, and the king sat. His throne was in that kind of an inset thing, and it was probably a security measure. Nobody could get behind him. He was safe sitting there, but they had a lampstand on one side, and the light shining out made it possible for him to easily see this hand when it appeared. And it was just a hand. And he saw the back of a hand as the hand was writing. And verse 6 says that his face grew pale and his thoughts alarmed him and his hip joints went slack and his knees began knocking together. This is where we probably got that original idea of your knees knocking. Because it says that he was so terrified that it was like the tendons and ligaments that were holding his bones together had stretched out and just lost all their elasticity. He was terrified. This guy was absolutely, probably drunk, but also instantly sober, terrified. And so the king called to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners, and he told the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck, and I have authority as third in the kingdom. Third, because Nabonidus, his dad, was out with some of the armies, and so he was still the king, even though Belshazzar was the sitting king in the city of Babylon. But the point here is that there's a marked difference in verse 7 between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar's approach to the stuff. What would Nebuchadnezzar have said? Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation won't be jerked for limb from limb, and if you can't, you will be, or, you know. He was heavy on the threat side of things, but Belshazzar made this promise that he would elevate whoever could interpret this up to third in the kingdom. It was a highly desirable position to be in, if that was your motivation in life. So they all came in, but they couldn't read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. And that made him even more alarmed, and his face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. The issue of them not being able to read the inscription or make known its interpretation, there's a lot of stuff written about what that might mean. There's some question as to whether the statement that they couldn't read it meant that they didn't recognize either the alphabet or the vocabulary or something along that line. But there's also the possibility that the reading was simply, they couldn't read it because it didn't make any sense to them at all. It was just four words, and one of them was duplicate. So it was three words with one of them duplicated. But anyway, the nobles were perplexed, but the queen enters the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles, and the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Don't let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And remember, that goes all the way back to chapter 2, when Daniel was first introduced into the issues of Babylon because the king had had a dream and he needed to have an interpretation. He said, there's a man in your kingdom, and in the days of your father, i.e. the grandfather, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners, because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, let now Daniel be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. Now, verse 11 indicates very clearly that Daniel had lost his position as the chief of the magicians and sorcerers. So he had been sidelined, sent out to pasture, whatever. At this stage in the game, Daniel is probably in his 80s, old man, and a young king, relatively young king, like most young kings, doesn't want granddad's advisors advising him. You know, they're like Solomon's son. They had the old heads that told him what to do that would have been good, but the young heads were hot-tempered and wanted to prove they were wiser and gave him bad advice, and it ended up splitting the kingdom. So that's what's going on here. Daniel has been put out to pasture somewhere, but the queen remembers him. And the issue of the queen here, I'm not at all sure that she's the wife of Belshazzar. She may have been the queen mother, because she clearly remembers Nebuchadnezzar and emphasizes that Belshazzar is his offspring. So Daniel's brought in, and the king says to him, are you that Daniel? And notice they're using Daniel now. She told him that his grandfather had renamed him, but they're using Daniel now. So Daniel's brought in, and this king says, are you that Daniel who's one of the exiles from Judah whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Now that I have heard about you may be a reference to what the queen told him, but I cannot imagine Belshazzar the king being ignorant of the way Nebuchadnezzar had his kingdom organized, and Daniel was the third man in the king. I mean, he sat in the king's gate. So there's no way he didn't know more than he's admitting here. And Daniel's going to accuse him of that too in a minute. But anyway, he says, I've heard of you that there's a spirit of God in you, and the illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now, the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you'll be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck. You'll have authority as the third in the kingdom. So, obviously, he's playing up to Daniel to try to get some understanding of what's been written on that wall, because that was really a scary thing that happened. You just put yourself in his shoes for a minute and ask yourself, how would I react if suddenly a hand started writing on the wall beside me, disconnected from anything else, just a hand? So, Daniel says, keep your gifts for yourself, or give the rewards to someone else. This is a typical old man who's had it. He basically has no patience with this man. He says, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father, and because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished he killed, and whomever he wished he spared alive, and whomever he wished he elevated, and whomever he wished he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. So now we have an indication of what he might have thought he was, because he's running with the donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he sets over it whomever he wishes. Now, this is just a recap by Daniel of the conflict of chapter 4 between God and Nebuchadnezzar because of the conflict in chapter 3. In chapter 2, God said this is the way it's going to be, and Nebuchadnezzar said in chapter 3, it is not going to be that way. And so God said, all right, you're going to have to learn. He's running this show, and for 7 years he thought he was a donkey or something similar, until he recognized that there's a God in heaven who rules. And this whole issue of relating to the God who rules in the kingdoms of men from heaven is absolutely fundamental issue for all of humanity. Human beings can drift through their life, their whole lifetime, and not give God a second thought. But it's an extremely dangerous process, because there is going to come a day when they're going to stand before this God that they wouldn't even give a thought to. And the standard of judgment against them will be that the greatest commandment in the universe was that they were supposed to have loved that God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And they didn't give him the time of day. And that's exactly like our culture today. Anyway, he says, yet you, his son, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. You've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand, but the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways you have not glorified. Now, I just read this morning in the book of the Judges how Gideon was told to pull down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah, and he did it at night because he was scared to do it in the day. But when the elders of the city saw what had happened, they found out it was him that did it. So they went to his daddy and said, bring him out. We're going to kill him for doing that. And his daddy said, you are not. He said, if Baal is a god, Let him contend himself. If he's a God, he can certainly take care of his own business. If my son has done something that offends him, then let him decide what he's going to do. You're not going to do it. And if you try, you'll die. So they backed off. But that's what Jerubbaal, that's why his daddy renamed him, because it means let Baal contend. So Daniel's pulling the same truth out of the hat here, because in God we have life and breath and all our ways. And that's the reason why we have this entire issue of the focus in the gospel on being reunited to the God in whom is our life, breath, and our ways. And it is his desire for us to be reconciled to him and have him as the center core of our life and thought and loves and everything else. And he's doing that by the gospel, because the tendency of man is to shut himself as far off from that kind of God as he can. Romans says, there's none good, not even one. There's not one that seeks after God. They're altogether gone out of the way. They've altogether become unprofitable. He said, their throat is like an open grave. And with their tongue, they deceive. And behind their lips is the poison of asps. And the imagery there is graphic. What he's saying is, human beings are like this. Outside of Christ, human beings are like this. They want to kill you. That's the grave. And the way they want to do that is they want to use their tongue to sucker you in, to get you far enough in to where the poison that's behind their lips can clamp down on you and you're dead. Now, isn't that a graphic picture of humanity? And still we have people who say, well, you know, there's good in everybody, and there's good people in the world, they just don't know Jesus, and all that kind of nonsense. Paul said, no, that ain't true. You get behind all the facade, and here's what you'll find. Corruption so profound that they are the children of the devil, who is a murderer from the beginning, and they're every one of them murderers from the beginning. So the gospel has been presented to humanity, to us as human beings, as an offer of returning to the Lord of life. And that's exactly what chapter 4 was all about. Nebuchadnezzar was brought to life by the Lord of heaven, and Nebuchadnezzar wrote his testimony to all of the empire of Babylon so that they would understand that there's a God in heaven who knows how to humble those who walk in pride, and this is how he dealt with me. And I give him praise and honor and glory for the lesson that I've learned from him. That's chapter 4. Belshazzar knows this, and Daniel accuses him of saying, you knew this, but you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, in whom is your life, breath, and your ways, and you have not glorified him. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. So, in a way, this is so atypical that we wish it was more typical. We really wish that God would be this kind of blunt more often, so that it would become a part of our thinking about him. When I was in Jasper as a pastor, we were there for 14 years, and I don't remember when in that time I read the article in the newspaper, but there was a guy that was fishing on a lake up in northeast Texas. He was a noted atheist, and he was out fishing in his boat, and a thunderstorm came up with lightning and wind, and you know, and he stood up in his boat and said, if there's a God, strike me dead. And lightning hit his fist and killed him dead. And you say, if God did that more often, there'd be more people giving some credibility to the claims of the truth. But the fact is, God absorbs a lot of this abuse without ever doing anything that's obviously from him. Now, he doesn't let it go. He brings judgment, and there's condemnation, and there's judgment. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven, Romans 1:18 says. It's a constant reality, but what we do is we dismiss it. It's not judgment. This is just nature on a rampage. And when some bad thing happens to somebody, instead of saying, this might be God's response to the way they've been making their choices and doing their behavior, instead of that, we just blow it off. This is the way it is. You know, we don't relate anything to God. And as a consequence, we're not brought to heal by the hard things that happen to us. And the fact is, from the beginning, when AIDS first blew out and everybody recognized that you could get, nurses were double gloving because if a spot of blood got on you, there were little tiny leaky holes in the gloves, so they had to put two on so that this hole would be covered. They were scared to death of getting AIDS by these fluids and blood and all that. But because the government and the culture decided to treat AIDS in a way that's no communicable disease of that potency has ever been treated. When the Black Plague hit Europe, what did they do? They quarantined everybody that came down with it. I mean, and that quarantine business has been a medical procedure ever since Israel was given responsibility to quarantine. But when it came down to AIDS, now we're going to quarantine these people. And we're not even going to send them to jail if they infect somebody else knowingly. So our culture has descended into the pit. But the fact is, God did respond this time with Belshazzar by sending a hand to write on the wall. And this was the inscription, verse 25. What was written out? Mene, Mene, Tekel, Epharsin. Now, unless the alphabet was really, really printed differently by that hand, those words are not hard to read. Now, you might not know what they meant, but they're not hard to read. And there is a whole lot of stuff that is put out as possibilities, but he gives us the interpretation of the message. He says, the word meaning basically means numbered. So, meaning means numbered. Well, what's a wise man supposed to make of that? Numbered. That doesn't make any sense. But to Daniel, he says, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. In other words, your days have run out. God counted your days and he numbered them. Double. And your kingdom has come to an end. Tekel, the middle word, is a word that means weighed. So we have numbered, weighed. It's not a sentence. It's just three words. And he says that this means you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. You're a little light. And then he switches the word eupharsin to peris. And the suggestion is that eupharsin is actually, the U is an and, in conjunction. So it's not eupharsin as a single word, but it's and pharsin. And pharsin has an alphabetical parallel to peris. And the word peris or eupharsin means destroyed by being divided into multiple pieces, pounded into the dirt. You remember chapter 2? The rock comes out, hits the image on, and breaks it in pieces and pulverizes it. Well, here, this idea is your kingdom has been destroyed. Not just divided, but destroyed and given over to the Medes and Persians. Now, this Medes and Persians is not a second and third kingdom things. You know, you're this kingdom, there's going to be a kingdom after you, another kingdom after you, and another kingdom after that. The Medes and the Persians were actually a coalition, and we called it the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Medes were early the dominant group, and that's why Darius the Mede in verse 31 takes over. But the Persians were the ascending power after that. And so we have Cyrus the Persian putting Daniel in the lion's den. So it didn't take very long for the Medes to lose their dominance in this cooperation between the Medes and the Persians. So basically he says, the problem here, King, is that you have been numbered. I'm telling you, numbered. And you have been weighed in the balance. And you have been found deficient and therefore are to be destroyed. This is what I call judgment without mercy. He didn't give him a chance to humble himself or to, you know, repent. Or he said, you had it. And that's it. That's one of the hardest things, I think, for us in our cultural Christianity to get a grip on these days. Because we want so badly for people to come to Christ and to be forgiven that we soft soap the issues of the harsh judgment of God's intolerance when he gets fed up. We tell everybody, he'll never get fed up. He'll always be willing to forgive you, you know. And in some ways that's true, but the issue of willingness to forgive is rooted in repentance, and repentance is not something you can just crank out. So, there is this shadow in the revelation about the God of the Bible. There's this shadow of the wrath of God that is in the background. The dominant thesis in our age is grace and mercy and love. But the grace and mercy and love have this backdrop of wrath, and without it, the grace, mercy, and love don't mean anything. There's a time when God responds to hard-heartedness by hardening the heart. The whole problem with the issues of faith and repentance and all that kind of stuff, the whole problem is the scriptures tell you early on that when you commit sin, you become a slave of it. And the more often you commit a particular sin, the more entrenched it becomes as a dominant part of your life. And there will come a time when you will not be able to extract yourself from it, if you were ever able to. And that's a big if. Because once you become a slave to it, you're not able to extract yourself by yourself. That's what the gospel of the mercy of God is all about. That God sent a Redeemer to deliver us. He sends His Spirit to woo us. And He draws us into His life. And He insists that we trust Him. And there are consequences for not. So, Belshazzar gave orders to the people, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom for the night. It lasted the rest of however, a few hours. That same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. So Darius the Mede, or Darius, depending on where you want to put the emphasis, received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Now, this business of the king being slain, when there's walls 300 feet tall and 75 feet thick at the top and bronze gates, and the city of Babylon was built across the river Euphrates so that there was a river flowing under the city. That meant they'd never run out of water. So behind those walls and those gates, you couldn't get them come out because they're thirsty. And they had stockpiled in the storehouses of Babylon food for 30 or 40 years. So if you're going to besiege the city, you couldn't get them to run out of water. They had the river Euphrates running under the walls of their city, and you couldn't wait 30 or 40 years. Old Darius wasn't sitting on his hands out there. Babylon had already dug a moat around the city so that the river Euphrates filled the moat as it flowed through the city, but the moat is... It was a large moat, and it filled the moat. Well, Darius got back over the hill where they couldn't see him, and he gave his soldiers command to dig a canal from this part of the Euphrates around the city to this part of the Euphrates. So they dug this canal all the way through, and then they got down here on this night, and they broke through the last piece of the canal and diverted the water. Well, as soon as the water could flow in that canal, well, the water level started dropping. And the soldiers went under the wall in the riverbed and up over the walls. And Belshazzar and all his nobles in their drunk didn't have a clue what was going on. And they swarmed them, killed them all. It was an amazing feat when you have hundreds of thousands of soldiers. I suppose you can give them all a shovel and they can get a lot of work done. But it was an amazing phenomenon that he was able to do that. And he diverted the flow of the Euphrates. And the soldiers just went down on the riverbed and up inside and over the walls and